This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, August 12th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll speak to a supply chain expert about the short and long-term impacts of the I-70 closure. Congress is considering a $3.5 trillion spending bill that would be largely paid for by raising taxes on corporations and on the wealthy. Results of a recent survey suggest taxing the rich is an extremely popular proposal among Colorado voters, particularly among unaffiliated swing voters. And what happens when you release billionaires into the wild? That's the subject of a book that researches the lives of the ultra-wealthy in the U.S. West. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. Then Kim Mooney will bring us her quarterly program on death and dying. Today, she examines cold cases. Then at 9:30, a mix of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All of that is coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. First, we'll start with the headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The Colorado Vaccine Equity Task Force is urging Governor Jared Polis and state and local health departments to require all school-aged children and staff to wear masks regardless of vaccination status, and to implement regular testing and other effective strategies known to curb the spread of COVID-19. The task force points out that while emerging data shows even vaccinated individuals can transmit the Delta variant of the virus, overwhelming evidence demonstrates face coverings decrease COVID-19 transmission. The group further states unmasked individuals in school settings, even if vaccinated, pose a risk to those not yet vaccinated, especially those under the age of 12. The group indicates that the CDC currently recommends that all unvaccinated students and staff wear masks in schools, and the American Academy of Pediatrics and the AAP Colorado have gone a step further, recommending universal masking in all schools. The U.S. Census Bureau will release a new round of data today. The data is based on the once-in-a-decade census that took place most recently in 2020. The information will influence the redrawing of districts, which could tip the balance of power in state and national legislative houses. Voting rights advocates have been calling on Congress to pass the For the People Act before states begin the redistricting process. The Colorado Department of Law has released a report on the state-level gun violence prevention measure known as the Red Flag Law. Steve Miller has more.
Colorado's Deputy Zachary Parrish III Violence Prevention Act, commonly known as the Red Flag Law, took effect on January 1, 2020. The Violence Prevention Act enables a judge to issue an extreme risk protection order that prohibits an individual from possessing firearms for up to 364 days. A judge needs to find that the individual poses a significant risk of causing personal injury to self or others by purchasing, possessing, or receiving a firearm. During the first year of implementation, families, household members, and law enforcement successfully use the Red Flag Law to intervene in cases where suicide, intimate partner, or mass violence were threatened. Year 1 data shows that of the 125 times the Red Flag Law was requested, law enforcement had filed 85% of the petitions. A review of 30 denied petitions showed that judges often found the requesters didn't show credible threats, were too vague, made procedural errors, or failed to provide all the required information. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser said that increasing the education, awareness, and training efforts on the protection order process can help save lives. He hopes that using the Red Flag Law will help prevent suicide and gun violence while protecting the rights of lawful gun owners. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Boulder Valley School District officials announced yesterday Fairview High School principal Don Stensrud has been placed on paid administrative leave as officials investigate Title IX lawsuit allegations against him and other school leaders. As mentioned on Monday's Morning Magazine, the Denver Post reports two former students filed a federal lawsuit last Friday asserting that the school district and Stansrud failed to investigate a lacrosse player accused of raping at least two other students during the 2016-2017 school year, and that students were not protected as they faced a hostile environment. The lawsuit alleges school administrators and Stansrud repeatedly turned a blind eye to rampant sexual harassment and abuse. Friday's lawsuit comes on the heels of the recent rape acquittal of Fairview's former quarterback and the plea deal of the remaining charges against him. Wildlife is being fenced in across the West, and researchers are now mapping these lines to understand how they affect animals. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Wildlife is being fenced in across the West, and researchers are now mapping these lines to understand how they affect animals. In some rural areas, fences outnumber roads, but they're much harder to pinpoint and map. Simon Bizard with the National Wildlife Federation is leading an effort to find fences and overlay that information with movement data for pronghorns in southwest Montana. He says the project is prioritizing fences that can directly hamper the species' migration patterns and can find trouble spots.
Where we see a stark line where all of a sudden all the animals move in a 90-degree angle and we see there's a fence there, we go out on the ground and take stock of what type of fence it is. Is the landowner interested in discussing opportunities for modification? Is it on public land?
He says identifying fences on the landscape that can be more wildlife-friendly is important, not only for pronghorn, but other species, elk, mule deer, moose, as well as ground-nesting birds like sage grouse. There are more than 77,000 pronghorn in Colorado, according to the State Division of Wildlife. For Colorado News Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Senate has unanimously confirmed Ken Salazar as the new U.S. ambassador to Mexico. Salazar is a former U.S. senator from Colorado and was the Interior Secretary under the Obama administration. The Denver Post reports Salazar is the first of President Joe Biden's ambassador nominees to be confirmed. In other political news, former Olympian and Air Force veteran Eli Bremmer from Colorado Springs announced Tuesday he will challenge Michael Bennett for the U.S. Senate seat in the next year's election. According to the Denver Post, Bremmer has never run for public office, but was the El Paso County GOP chairman from 2011 to 2013. Today's weather is predicted to be sunny with a high near 87. This evening, there is a 10% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Although it is predicted to be sunny, air quality will once again be poor today. The temperature outside at the Boulder Studios is currently 66 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. It has been almost 2 weeks since a mudslide from the 2020 Grizzly Creek fire burn scar closed down part of Interstate 70 through Glenwood Canyon. Wednesday morning, CDOT and Governor Jared Polis announced a partial reopening is scheduled to begin Saturday. However, the closure has already had an impact on state and local economies. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke with Greg Macaluso, a professor of the graduate level program in supply chain management at the Leeds School of Business at CU Boulder. They talked about the ripple effect this closure and other pandemic related disruptions are having on local supply chains.
Professor Macaluso, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
To begin, tell us what kind of a role an interstate like I-70 plays in the Colorado supply chain and the national supply chain.
Sure. Overall, I-70 is part of the what we'll call the major lanes of traffic, east-west traffic in the United States. So interstates that folks are familiar with that end in zeros tend to be the highest commercial traffic carrier interstate highways. I-70 is probably in the top half. I-70 is what I'll call a mid-range carrier.
So I'm curious, when a supply chain disruption like this happens, what are the short-term and long-term impacts?
On the short-term, it's an inconvenience, and it's usually measured in detour time. I've checked out the most viable alternatives for what we'll call heavy commercial traffic. We'll take about a four-hour detour out of what would traditionally be the pass, you know, through the 30-mile stretch that's now closed. A four-hour detour is inconvenient. it messes with scheduling. But in the short term, the folks that plan freight take that into account very quickly, and they look for alternatives very quickly. In the long term, or in the bigger picture, it's another complicator. It's another disruptor. And the way I like to describe it is, over the last 50 years or so, we've made the supply chains internationally, globally, domestically, more efficient, more capable, faster speeds. And the metaphor that I use is, picture, everybody's familiar with NASCAR, two cars going 200 miles an hour, where one car is following the other, you know, 3 inches apart going 200 miles an hour. That's the way that we've tried to design supply chains, so that they're nimble, they're able to adjust, and they're able to go very, very fast at a very, very low cost. The downside of that is it typically doesn't have a lot of buffer in it. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
And so then when there's disruption, like I-70 closure, or globally, like a pandemic or the Suez Canal or a spike in a particular commodity market like lumber, these are all disruptors that cause the supply chain to create doubt amongst its constituents. And so naturally, just like the metaphor for the NASCAR, what you do when you're not sure what the car in front of you is going to do, you start to back up. You start to create space between you. Because just in case they do something you don't expect, you have to protect yourself. And so that space translates in this metaphor to time and money. And that's what folks have experienced in all kinds of commodities like computer chips and so forth. Now, on the micro basis, Palisade Peaches to the eastern half of the state, for example, will have what I'll call the inconvenience disruption. But in supply chain planning overall, folks will start doing speculation into the supply chain to protect their own company's interests. And that's usually where we get into longer delays and more significant and more complex problem solving in supply chains.
So Colorado has asked for $116 million in aid from the federal government to reopen I-70 through Glenwood Canyon. But Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Transportation awarded Colorado $11.6 million in quick release emergency relief funding. Did that quick release funding come as a surprise to you, or were you expecting that kind of aid to come to address this closure?
For the purposes of reopening the corridor, in what I'll call an emergency or temporary basis, that's probably commensurate with what you would expect. There's a long-term issue in the canyon. I'm not an engineer or familiar with the details, but there's a long-term issue there that road crews have been talking about for years. And that is continually is either a mudslide, a rock slide, some other natural phenomena that closes that canyon. And the number of alternatives through that canyon, you know, we all experienced as Coloradoans when I-70 was first built through there. There really weren't geographic options. There weren't a lot of geographic options that could carry interstate traffic. And so our options are limited. And so the short answer to your question is, yeah, that money is probably appropriate for the purposes of commerce and getting the highway open. I would just be concerned about the long-term implications of our alternatives through the canyon, as it's obviously suspect to all kinds of natural phenomena.
So it looks like a partial reopening, maybe days away opposed to weeks away. It looks like there could be a single lane open as early as this weekend. Do you expect something like a single lane reopening to have much of an impact on the supply chain woes these mudslides and the closure has caused?
Yeah, I would say if something like that occurred, I would call the inconvenience that we talked about earlier, the inconvenience of going 4 hours out of your way would start to diminish. But the ripple effect in supply chain from a longer term perspective, along those stories that I was telling earlier, probably will remain for some time. Any number of commodities intrastate that have to go from the Western Slope are impacted significantly. So anything that would open the canyon would be a big deal to the folks that are affected locally.
And I know some people are wondering if there should have been more of a defense in place to protect against this sort of supply chain disruption. What are your thoughts on those opinions?
I think there's a perception that supply should be available no matter what. And the thing that I would add to that is that comes at a price. Think of it as insurance, for example. So if you bet that you're going to have a disruption, it's one of those 3.7-year disruptions, you'd have to buffer with a certain amount of insurance. And then the question comes, would consumers be willing to pay for that insurance? And my answer to that, or what I've seen from from most economic settings is consumers, when given the option, will choose low cost and fast all the time. So they're unwilling to pay for that insurance. And that is at least one perception that I would add to the conversation is when you ask for this security blanket, know that that comes at a cost. And historically, we've been unwilling to pay for it. So most likely the supply chains of the future will be the ones that you saw pre-COVID, at least for, you know, probably a 6-year run there. Relatively fast, relatively high availability, relatively low cost, but not a lot of buffer.
So what can or should consumers or business owners do to defend themselves against the impacts of this kind of a supply chain disruption? Doing your research and seeing what you've seen in your work, what advice do you have for consumers as well as for business owners?
Yeah, let's take the business to business transactions and commerce and supply chain first. Two things. One, order the quantities that are required rather than hedging, doubling down, slowing. Order at the pace that you actually want to consume. That's one signal that at least propagates a true signal through the supply chain. And then second, if you haven't already done it, develop a way to have a transparent relationship with not only your transport carriers, but with your suppliers so that you can be more proactive with them. You can get a state of the union with them and then collaborate better on how best to order and how best to move things. Those would be my two suggestions for business to business. And then on the consumer side, my suggestion is similar. Buy what you need. Try not to hoard. Try not to project into the supply chain. Order what you require at the time you require it. And second, you may need to be patient. And folks have asked me, you know, how long will it take before we see, quote, normalcy? Boy, I wish I had a crystal ball, but I would say if we can get some of these disruptions to calm down, you should see the supply chain normalize, I would expect, in 9 to 18 months.
And that was Professor Greg Macaluso, a professor of supply chain management, teaching supply chain management at the graduate level at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder. Professor Macaluso, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thanks so much for reaching out. I appreciate it.
For KGNU, I'm Hanley Myers.
The Senate passed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill this week with bipartisan support. As its name suggests, the bill lays out a plan for improving, repairing, and expanding the nation's infrastructure network. But Democrats and the Biden administration are pushing for a broader $3.5 trillion spending bill that would expand services for families, like making the advanced child tax credit payments permanent and providing public support for elder care and universal pre-K. That proposal does not have bipartisan support, namely because its funding calls for reversing the Trump-era corporate tax cut and raising taxes on the richest Americans. But Frank Clemente, executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness, says the broad bipartisan support for the infrastructure bill is a positive sign.
What this does is it sets out the parameters or the framework for this debate or for this budget reconciliation process, the $3.5 trillion level. But what has to be figured out in later this month and in September, possibly voted on as early as September, but maybe into October, is what are the components of the tax increases that are going to exist in this budget reconciliation bill? First question is it going to be $3.5 trillion? Is it going to be fully paid for? Or is some of it going to be paid for in other ways? Or is some of it going to be deficit finance? But the second is, of these elements, what is going to be what's going to be able to get the 51 votes?
Americans for Tax Fairness, along with the Colorado Fiscal Institute and Progress Now Colorado, released the results of a survey this week that shows taxing the rich is actually a very popular policy proposal. Guy Molyneux is a partner at Hart Research Associates, a group that conducted the July poll of Colorado voters.
The one that voters were most likely to say should be an extremely important priority for the president and Congress is at the top here, ensuring that the wealthy and corporations pay their fair share of taxes. That's also true for the unaffiliated voters, you can see on the right. And that places it well ahead of rebuilding infrastructure, expanding clean energy, creating jobs, access to childcare, not just, you know, something that people will consider, but really an extremely popular and important goal in the eyes of Colorado voters.
The voters that supported the measure the most were unaffiliated voters, which are often swing voters. Democratic House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi has indicated she will not schedule a vote on the $1 trillion infrastructure bill until the Senate votes on the larger $3.5 trillion spending bill. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. We now turn to Wyoming, a Rocky Mountain regional neighbor with tax laws designed to draw wealthy individuals seeking to minimize their obligations to the U.S. Treasury. The book Billionaire Wilderness, The Ultra Wealthy and the Remaking of the American West came out in March 2020. Unfortunate timing for a book tour. However, author and Yale University professor Justin Farrell has been back on the road across the Mountain West this summer to talk about what he learned from 5 years of studying the ultra-wealthy of Teton County, Wyoming. Kyle Mackey of KHOL Jackson Hole Community Radio spoke with Farrell ahead of a recent talk in Jackson.
Let's just get right into it. You do not mince words in Billionaire Wilderness. You describe in great detail how the ultra-wealthy use nature to solve economic dilemmas, often benefiting from like the positive community feedback of environmental philanthropy, while at the same time further enriching themselves. You describe how they often mistake relationships that are based on economic exchange as genuine friendships. And I'm dying to ask you, what has the reaction been to your book from these ultra wealthy people who you interviewed and who were generous with their time and who I'm sure you got to know over the course of your 5 years of research?
I did. Yeah, I still have great relationships. So some of them, you know, there wasn't this intense blowback that you might expect. But as a social scientist, I know that that's probably biased in the sense of those who are upset, you know, may not reach out. But overall, I think that most people, even if they disagree with some of my interpretation of maybe their relationship with someone who works for them or their relationship with their fishing guide or something like that, that I used really, you know, good data and that I told the story in a way that was hopefully accurate. And I really went to great lengths to do that, even though, you know, at times, usually with their own quotes, it can be quite critical and even cringe-inducing for some people.
So I wondered if you could talk about some of the policy reforms that you discuss in the book and some kind of maybe practical takeaways that folks might want to grasp onto if they're feeling depressed about what you have written.
Yeah. So I at the end of the book, I have this epilogue, and it was really difficult to write because things are changing so quickly. And so I shied away, actually, of recommending specific policies. And a lot of times, academics are not very good at that. So I have these broad recommendations, and it starts with first requiring more from the ultra wealthy, and that can happen in lots of different ways. Through, you know, a tax on luxury real estate transfers. At the state level, I talk about Wyoming's lack of an income tax. I talk about lack of a corporate tax. And so there's some really easy remedies on paper, but the state of Wyoming is not instituting an income tax anytime soon. Then I have, you know, as a sociologist, I'm really interested in studying community and what makes a community. And this is a little more mushy, and rather than just saying, you know, institute this policy or the town council should do this, or here's how you fix the housing crisis, which is, let's not even get into that. But what type of community do you want to be? Who belongs in the community? What gives a community character? And starting at that broad level with those types of questions, and then moving from there with the policy.
Right. Well, clearly some of the issues you just mentioned, like housing crises and this growing gap between the ultra wealthy and working poor residents, you know, the squeeze on the middle class, that's not just a Jackson problem. We know that this is a Bozeman problem and a Boise problem and, you know, even a Denver and like Seattle problem to some extent. Can you talk more regionally about your research and the new Western Research Center that you're the director of at Yale?
Yeah. So I direct this lab that we call Lab for Western Lands and People. And it's to conduct research and high quality research, social science, natural science, a blend of the two, humanities, and to make room for all of that and to to approach some of these questions that I was just talking about in terms of what makes a community, what makes the West special, what makes these rural places special, how does a place like Jackson relate to a place like Rock Springs or something like that? Just, and we're essentially instituting a program at Yale via myself and my students to really look at some of these topics and really focusing on rural gentrification, focusing on the impact of that, for example, on ecological health, and really taking a holistic approach.
Billionaire Wilderness was published, I believe, in March 2020, right as the world changed and we were thrown into the coronavirus pandemic. So first of all, I guess, how did that affect just the publishing of the book? And I'm sure it impacted your promotion of it. But also, you know, how has the pandemic impacted the trends and the status quo that you wrote about?
Yeah. So the book came out in March 2020. And I had this – well, I didn't. The book press had this huge tour lined up, all East Coast, West Coast – and 2 days before, it was just all canceled. I really wasn't too concerned about it. But in looking back, it was sort of a bummer just because I didn't get out and chat with people about this. And I couldn't come to Jackson to give a talk. As far as the pandemic, I mean, it's thrown gasoline on a fire that was, as I argue in the book, that's the whole topic, that was already burning. And it's almost like this turbocharger for everything. And it's honestly, I knew we were on that trajectory in places like here, all around Colorado, Utah, Idaho now, some parts of Montana. But I think I underestimated the impact it would have and the way that the Zoom boom, Zoom towns or whatever you want to call it, just exploded. Places like Bozeman where you see, you know, a doubling of the price of a single family home. Places like here who, you know, people are buying homes in Colorado too, you know, $10, $15 million homes without ever seeing them. I, moving forward, wonder obviously what this is going to look like in a couple of years. Are those homes going to remain vacant? You know, we already see in some areas, some of these homes are in towns, like 70% of homes are vacant. Meanwhile, there's a housing crisis. And so what is that going to look like? And I don't think we know quite yet, but that's a really important question and one that I'm going to be pursuing.
Okay, great. Well, Justin Farrell, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us at K2L.
Great. Thanks so much.
And that does it for today's Morning Magazine here on listener-supported community radio. I've been your host, Shannon Young.